Already in this series, we've looked at two examples of striking orderliness in the underpinning of human behaviour. Myths themselves appear to show remarkably regular patterns in all parts of the world, and I've also pointed out to you the striking orderliness also of animal symbols. And indeed, this animal symbol orderliness can be extended into all areas of symbols, colours, and so on. Now, when we look at human behaviour, perhaps to most of us, the most striking feature is its disorderliness, a sense of a total shambles. But it is fairly clear when we look at the way in which people behave, and even at their motives, that there is an order underlying all this. I suppose lots of people who live in modern Britain have a feeling that the universe is very orderly, but human behaviour is not. But in fact, all the evidence that I can muster indicates that underlying the apparent shambles of human behaviour, there is in fact some remarkable order, not just myths and symbols, which are operating in the sphere of the ideal, I suppose one could say, but also in much more mundane aspects of human life too. There is a great deal of implicit order, and although I don't want to try and exhaust that order in this series, in this concluding lecture I'd like to draw together a few threads which you can examine further for yourselves. As I've emphasised throughout this series, it is important that you look at the evidence yourself, that you not simply accept or reject what I'm saying. What I'm saying is a set of models. All of them can be tested. Let me begin with the question of what people want, because this is extremely orderly and regular across the world. If you look at the diagram which is provided, you will see that I've arranged things in a double column. There's a sequence of features. The exact order which one adopts here is not perhaps critical, nor am I trying to show all the things which are involved, but fundamentally, on the right-hand side, the auspicious side, are those things that people want. On the left-hand side, the inauspicious side, and incidentally that's regular across the world, are the things that people do not want. On the right-hand side is life, on the left-hand side is death. On the right-hand side is health, on the left-hand side is illness. On the right-hand side is prosperity, on the left-hand side is disaster. And similar pairs are happiness and unhappiness, success and failure. As a matter of interest, working through this sort of sequence in terms of right hand and left hand, male is regularly on the left hand side and male is regularly on the right hand side and female is equally regularly on the left hand side. But this should not lead us immediately to the conclusion, that means female is death and male is life, or female is illness and male is health. It's not quite as simple as that. Presumably the reason why female is on the left-hand side is because women are much more powerful than men and therefore implicitly more dangerous. I've dealt with that already in this series. As I say, we could go on. We could go on putting left and right pairs well beyond this particular short list. But the point is, it is worth bearing in mind that human beings do have particular values associated with what they would like the world to be. I've already pointed out to you in the context of myths, and you probably realise by now we've covered quite a lot of ground in this series. But in the context of myths, I've already pointed out to you that things always go wrong, that what people want are, in a sense, always inaccessible things, because what's going to happen is always going to be some kind of fouling up of what we want. A younger brother Coyote will always come along and mess up the beautiful system which was set up by the wise wolf. And so it goes on. We may begin, like the Nua, sex-free, but sooner or later, for reasons unknown, sex rears its ugly head and everything starts going wrong. And so it goes on in one story after another. Now, one of the factors which one has to take into account when we look at the way in which what people want, this ideal universe that people aspire to, is not attainable, is because people themselves have got forces inside them which are making it impossible to attain these wonderful states which are at least theoretically attainable. When we look at the last 200 years or the last 2,000 years, it's fairly clear, at least to some of us, that if people had really wanted happiness, prosperity, and good health, then by now they'd pretty certainly have them. There's very good evidence that people don't want them, that people suffer from death wish, that they suffer from a desire for self-laceration, that they don't really want all that much to be happy. There are all sorts of forces inside people driving them towards unhappiness. Sometimes when you see the sort of mess that many individuals have made of their lives, you wonder whether they get up in the morning and think of new ways of making a total screw-up of themselves in the course of the next week. Now, when we look at the forces operating inside people, there are certainly three we've got to take seriously, even in a summary such as this one. Very briefly, I call them the three great hang-ups, and I'll say a bit more about them in a moment. But to summarise them, first of all, is the fear of death, which we've already flagged at the beginning of this lecture. Then comes the disgust at being sexual, and then comes the horror of being animals. Now, some people would want to elaborate this system. The people whom in taxonomic circles we call splitters would not be happy with the disgust at being sexual. They would want to break it down into smaller groupings. They would make issues and indeed headings out of adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, masturbation, and various others, doubtless coprophilia and a whole host of other individual topics, necrophilia, for example. I'm not going to try and exhaust them, but I can see the splitters' point. The splitters always do have a point, irritating though they may be to people who are groupers, and I regard myself as a sort of moderate grouper. Nevertheless, the splitters always do have a point, irritating though that may be, and I can see why some people would want to emphasise the smaller scale of things. They would rather emphasise, shall we say, the issue of homosexuality or masturbation, rather than emphasising the general problem of disgust at being sexual. But the point is, these wider issues do hang together into a bigger complex. And I ought to add that at the other end of the scale from the splitters are the extreme groupers who would say that what I have called the three great hang-ups are really one great hang-up, that there really is only one great hang-up, and that is the problem of being human itself, the sort of cosmic angst of la condition humaine, which is itself a problem. What I've called the three great hang-ups are only three of its faces or its facets. And again, I can see their point too. Yes, you know, that's a very good point, which I can't shrug off. I can't simply brush it under the carpet. And at the same time, of course, when you look at what I've called the three great hang-ups, you realise that they do have a lot in common, that fundamentally death and sex are actually part of the problem of being animals, that human beings appear to aspire to a spiritual condition, and we've touched on this already in the series too, they appear to aspire to a spiritual condition which is fundamentally divorced from that of being human. The Nua tell the story of how we began, and when we began, we were sex-free, like God Almighty. In the same way, in discussing animal symbols, I've had to draw your attention to the fact that human beings occupy a very peculiar position in relation to the animals. Their relations with animals are very ambiguous. In one sense, we are animals. In another sense, we don't want to be. And you begin to realise that the threads of this series come together, that you may think that we started with a set of rather disparate topics, but after a bit, those topics flow into each other, they intermesh, they interweave with each other. And this is part of what I'm getting at here, that there is a system of ritual and belief. We're not just dealing with one isolated topic after another. There is some sort of coherent system underpinning it all. Now, when we look, therefore, at what the human hang-ups are, we can, in a sense, compare it to the view of the divine in India. In an Indian context of relevance, we can take the view that God is one, or that God is three, or that God is many. All of those claims are equally true within a genuinely Indian context, though understandably things get more complicated when you find immigrants who are Muslims and Christians and Jews, and indeed those immigrants have converts within the Indian population. But in the sort of pristine classical India, which perhaps is a bit more theoretical than real, in that pristine classical India, God is one, God is three, and God is many all at once. The same sorts of taxonomic issues arise when dealing with human hang-ups. That may be purely coincidental, and it may not, but I'm not going into it now. What we do come across when we look at these hang-ups, and by the way, you must examine these hang-ups for yourselves. I'm not going to elaborate what the evidence is for these, but there is abundant evidence. When we look at these hang-ups, we find that there is an issue here which is to do with people's animality or spirituality. People find themselves in the universe in the position of a kind of middle class. They fear, as all middle classes do in human contexts, that they will sink into the classes below them. In the cosmic system, of course, that is the animals, as we've dealt with in an earlier lecture. And like all middle classes, human beings are basically snobs, and they aspire upwards to hobnob with the divinities, and even better, of course, to get the occasional invitation from God Almighty. Human beings, therefore, like all middle classes, are in a rather uncomfortable position. They find themselves in the middle tier of the universe. They could, in the snakes and ladders game, go down. They could go up. But they're in constant tension between the animals below them and the divine authorities above them. They aspire to spirituality, as we've seen in that Nua story about how we began sex-free, but they find themselves constantly dragged down to the level of the pigs and the dogs and the rats, who are, of course, animals basically and indeed embarrassingly rather similar to human beings. Now, it is perhaps in this context worth adding a commentary about the whole feature of this animality which worries us in the context of being sexual. Like other animals, people are sexual, and indeed they are sexual in very similar ways to other mammals, which is rather disturbing to a lot of people. And of course, within the context of industrial societies, there have been desperate efforts to cope with what is seen as the problem of sex, to pretend that really sex isn't too bad after all. But the only comment I would like to make about this is children's reaction to sexual activity. What you'll find in all societies of which we have any records whatever is that children always disapprove of copulation. They disapprove of the sexual activities of elders. They have a feeling that once people are grown up, they should be sensible enough not to do this kind of thing. And since none of us really grow up, we remain children all our lives, this horror of sexuality stays with us, and the hang-ups do not go away. So that, of course, we find that in activities which require an extreme virtue, when, for example, Kikuyu in East Africa want to beat the bounds of their ritual areas, what they do is that those people who go and beat the bounds are not the adult males and the adult females who are engaged in sexual activities, but the children who haven't yet started and the old people who have stopped, because these people will behave in a way which is ritually proper and pure and will not offend the ancestors or the spirits of the wild places or Almighty God. In other words, people, beings who are themselves sex-free. Back to the newer theme again. Now, I'm not going to elaborate this, but the point is, let's come back to the basic patterns which we find all across the world. What we find is that there is always this three-tiered universe, which I've told you something about when dealing with animal symbols, and we come back to it now. What we find is that at the top layer there is the divine, in the middle layer there are people, and at the lower layer there are the animals. Although, of course, as I pointed out to you, there is this ambiguity in modern English. In one sense, the sense of Linné and his classification of living forms, human beings are animals, they are in the regnum animale, the animal kingdom. They're not plants, and they're not rocks, they're not minerale. But at the same time, of course, in day-to-day spoken English, the expression, he behaved like an animal, is an implication that we are not animals, and indeed that we are a lot better than animals. And that ambiguity is not going to go away. It is there. That's part of the problem of being human, that it's full of these ambiguities. So that part of the order of the system in which we operate is an order of ideals, that to which we aspire. Then we have an order of hang-ups, that which gets in the way, whether we like it or not, and usually we don't. And then there is an order of a tiered universe in which we as human beings occupy an uncomfortable position in the middle, pulled downwards by our animality, to put it in rather abstract terms, called upwards by our desire to associate with divine beings, but at the same time, of course, finding that that process upwards, that upward mobility, that sort of cosmic yuppie aspiration that we have, is being constantly affected by the downpull of our animality. In a sense, of course, you could say that is what this course is all about. It really is about this particular diagram, this particular way of looking at it. When we look at human groups across the world, however, we find not only this set of generalities, but also some spatial generalities which are on the level at which we as human beings are living. And this is where it gets a bit confusing, because as I've emphasized earlier in this series, basically, human beings everywhere have lived in small communities. The hunting band, the village, the ward of an urban centre. These are the basis of human activity. And at this point, we have to remind ourselves again, as if we needed to remind ourselves, that the context of these lectures in the University of Kent in England is a rather peculiar context. The context in which we're operating is the context of the Industrial Revolution, the generation of the industrial countries, and the increasingly bizarre social features which are associated with that Industrial Revolution and its consequences in a postmodern age, as modern Europe comes to an end and we enter its postmodern phase, we find that things become increasingly weird. And I do need to say just a few words about that. In a way, of course, it takes us off into the next lecture series. It's a subject in itself, but we do have to say a little about it. Before I do that, however, let me say something about the normal. Supposing you are a normal person, like a bushman living in the Kalahari. Supposing you are a normal person, like an Amazonian Amerindian, living in a clearing in the wet forest. Your world is bounded, in some respects, of course, by the animals, and in some respects by the superhuman powers. This is the vertical diagram that I've been talking about. But it's also bounded by the little clearing in which you live, or the encampment which you have set up for the night. Outwards, beyond that, is the other world, the world of the spirits of the wild places. Equatorial forests are particularly convenient in this respect because the edge of the clearing is very sharp. You step out of the sunlight into the darkness of the forest. It is instant. Your awareness of that contrast between the human inhabited oikoumene and the world of the other, the world of the spirits, that contrast is really very, very dramatically relevant. It is immediate. It is something which you can feel in a moment. Rather more difficult, of course, when you live in Luton or Surbiton or Streatham. You don't have that sense of contrasts. And that is one of the features, of course, which is so important about the peculiarity of living in big urban contexts. But picking up threads that we've seen throughout this series, that edge of the inhabited area, that point where you step into the world of the wild places and the spirits who live there, this is terribly important in understanding human behaviour. And although we do not know what people were like, shall we say, 500,000 years ago, or what they were like 3 million years ago, it is perhaps a safe guess that one of the key features of their world was this contrast between the in here, where we live, and the out there, where the spirits of the wild places live. And if I had to guess what our primeval ancestors were like, I would suspect that they share with us the features which I'm outlining in this lecture, that they were people like us and they operated in terms of dyads like these dyads. But of course, the evidence for this is not positive. What we know about them is the stone tools that they've left behind. We don't even know about their wooden and their bone and shell tools because those have perished. And we know a bit, though not an awful lot, about their skeletons and about their teeth. But one does have this feeling that, you know, the world in which we live, which is basically human, we share probably perceptually with them. That is one of those things which has come through to us from their time. In terms of the inside and the outside, it is important to say something about not only people's relations with other animals, but also their relations with other groups of human beings. Within the Amazonian context, for instance, basically the people in the next clearing are foreigners. What you live in is a little universe of clearings in the wet forest. Each of those clearings is a tightly knit human grouping, including not an awful lot of people, possibly in some cases as little as 50 in number. 100, a large one perhaps would be 150, but you're dealing with groups of people who are essentially face-to-face. They know each other, they recognise each other instantly, they can probably recognise each other's voices as well as their faces. They know the family histories of people in that grouping. They know which of them are descended from recent or fairly recent immigrants. It takes three generations or more for people to forget that you are an immigrant, that you belong to an immigrant family. And although memories are fairly short, after about five generations, most of what happened may be forgotten. Nevertheless, it may take you five generations to actually cease to be an immigrant. Now, in these kind of societies, and we have good reason to believe that these were the kind of societies people lived in 2 million years ago, 3 million years ago, when you live in these kind of societies, there are, of course, great certainties. By and large, your sense of the world in which you live is coloured by what the people whom you regularly meet are like. Normally, too, of course, when you come in contact with people from other villages who are not your own people, you can't trust them, they may even be your enemies. Nevertheless, culturally, they're usually very like yourself, which has a sort of reassuring effect. Until, of course, down the river come these strange Europeans who are not like you at all and who do not have the effect of reassuring your sense of yourself. In the same way, of course, if you're an Australian Aboriginal for literally tens of thousands of years, your view of yourself is reinforced because most of the people with whom you come into contact are fundamentally people very like yourself. Until, of course, the Europeans come and set up this colony on the coast, which is totally different from anything you have known. Now, in terms of basic morality, therefore, what has happened in the human story is that fundamentally morality has been very restricted. People have operated in a moral world which has not involved obligations to very large groups of people. And this is a feature which is of some importance because very often people who operate in big cities are confused by the fact that three times, and only three times, in recorded history, people have set out on a moral adventure which treats the world as if it is the village and which treats human beings as if they all have in common a vast shared set of moral obligations. The three times are the beginnings of the Buddhists, the beginnings of the Christians, and the beginnings of the Muslims. And interestingly enough, as you probably realise, those three bids into what I suppose we can fairly call universal morality. Everybody who is human is my brother or my sister, lives in my village. Those three bids are associated on the one hand with the ascetics, the meditating ascetics of northern India, out of whose basic world came the Buddhists, and on the other hand, the Jews, the people out of whom came the Christians and the Muslims. In other words, the basic tendency of human beings isn't to produce these great universalistic movements. The tendency is very much more markedly parochial. Now, in the course of what has happened, one ought to pay attention not only to the setting up of these extraordinary mega-movements, these world missionary movements, which have set out not only to treat other people as members of my own moral community, but also, of course, to convert other people to our way of life and therefore bring them in to a practical world village or a practical world community. A lot of the media go on at the present time in Britain about the way in which we're now living in a global village and the way in which globalisation has occurred. They tend to attribute it to the amazing achievements of people who speak English. What they tend to forget is that the roots of this process were very firmly established by the Buddhists some 5 centuries before Jesus was born, and that Jesus and his followers took the next step when they exploded out of the fairly limited but increasingly cosmopolitan world of the Jews into the next world mission. The roots of globalization are deep. They go back far beyond the time of the prophet in Mecca. They go back even well beyond the time of Jesus in Nazareth. And this cumulative process of globalization has accelerated slowly. The wild claims for the amazing achievements of the English speakers have to be put in perspective. And, of course, the process of globalization has been hugely helped by military conquest. The great achievements of the English speakers are fundamentally strategic, more than anything else, to do with the way ships have developed their gunnery, the way in which armies have been disciplined. The English speakers are good at winning. So were the Italians. So were the Turks. So were the Greeks. So were the Persians. So were the Chinese. The people who were good at winning built the empires, and the empires encouraged people to treat each other a lot more decently than they would have done if there hadn't been empires. If you lived in the Roman Empire, you were expected to be nice to people from distant provinces. Your basic inclinations, of course, were perfectly normal and human and parochial. You had no wish whatever to be nice to people who were British or who came from Gaul. You were inclined to be nice to people in the group of villages in your part of Greece where you lived. But it is true, of course, that the great empires, the units which Toynbee called universal states, have also played a part in globalization, just as the mega movements, the universal churches, as Toynbee called them, people like the Muslims and the Christians and the Buddhists, have also played a part. There's a parallel process going on here by which, once you have state organization, once you have government, once you have royalty, then the next development is towards globalization, both by the secular route, the building of empires of conquest, and also by the more spiritual route, the process of proselytization, conversion, and spontaneous reorganization as the converts move towards their local realization of the global village. It does all make some sort of sense. You can realize, if you put it together, what has been happening. But of course, the problem is that the basic tendency of setting up an empire or of setting up an international moral community such as the Muslims is in fact to violate that fundamental human tendency, which is to look at strangers as suspect or even hostile. And you will notice, of course, that all the empires of which we have elaborate historical records up to now have broken up, and it seems extremely likely that the ones that still exist, the ones of the Chinese and the Russians and the English speakers, will themselves break up in time. There's no evidence for any stability or durability in these human secular structures, these attempts, as it were, to grope towards the global village. At the same time, one notices, and some people find this very disturbing, the fact, of course, that the mega movements themselves, the great missionary movements, have an internal tendency to split. The Buddhists have split into 2 great groupings, Theravada and Mahayana, and then they have sub-split within them. Japanese Buddhism, although broadly Mahayana, is a very different kind of process from Tibetan Buddhism, which is also within the broad context of Mahayana, but definitely very distinctive from Japanese. The Christian Church, again, has split into the mega dyads of Western and Eastern, and then split again into smaller groupings. The Armenians are very distinctive. The Poles are very distinctive. The Irish are very distinctive. The Ethiopian Highlanders are very distinctive indeed. And when we turn to the Muslims, whom a lot of people in Europe tend to regard as strangely monolithic, unlike the dreadful bickering Christians, we find, of course, that really it's not the case at all. Like the Buddhists and the Christians, the Muslims have had their great dyadic split between Shia and Sunna, and then, of course, these groupings have split again, just like the Christians and the Buddhists. And one realizes, of course, that this great quest towards a world in which we all speak to each other in the single language of brotherly love runs up against certain very serious problems in what people are really like. Basically, human beings are definitely parochial, and they even suspect, much of the time, that other human beings aren't really human at all. They're subhuman, or in some way, not human. Now, it's not really my purpose in a course of this kind to try and summarise world history, fascinating and challenging though that may be, but it is perhaps necessary, as I've indicated already, to say something about the peculiarities of what it is to be a member of an industrial society in the late 20th century and on into the 21st. It is very tempting to call this period postmodern, because so much of what Europeans associate with the modern appears to be crumbling or evaporating. The sense that modern history is over is very interesting. It's interesting that so many people should feel that it is, that the world of Columbus and Vasco da Gama, the world of Livingstone and of Gladstone, the world of the European great powers of the 18th and 19th centuries, that all of this is gone. It's an interesting feeling that people should have that sense, you know, that with Elgar onwards, we are in a sense singing the elegy of European civilization. Now, as a matter of fact, there is very good reason to believe that European civilization is just about over. It might have about 200 years left, probably not much more. But one has to be very cautious about this, because after all, both anthropology and history are fundamentally about facts. They're not about speculations. Speculations have to be left very carefully to one side. If we deal with facts and say, now, what is peculiar about places like Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Japan, at the present time? What has happened to them which sets them apart from their own modern past, and which also makes them difficult places to talk about, partly because we don't yet know where they're going, what they're going to become, but also difficult to talk about because they don't really fit into the various basic patterns which we associate with more standard peoples. I won't call them traditional peoples because we're all traditional, everybody has traditions. One of the characteristics of human societies is that they are traditional. The United Kingdom is very traditional. Japan is very traditional, loaded with tradition. But at the same time, there is some sense in which these places are not normal. The Japanese are still perhaps more normal than the European examples of industrial societies. One notices, for example, how remarkably low their crime rates are. But nevertheless, they're not that normal. And the likelihood, if anything, is that the Japanese and the South Koreans will become increasingly abnormal, like the Canadians, the Americans, the British, the French, the Germans, and so on. Now, what is this abnormality which I have been talking about? As I say, it really deserves a course of lectures of its own, but I do have to say something about it, because what I have been saying in this series has been addressed primarily to the hunters and gatherers, to the small-scale cultivators, the small-scale pastoralists, to the pastoral states, and to the cultivating states. It's been addressed preeminently to people like Bushmen in the Kalahari and Amerindians in the Amazon basin and cattle-keeping pastoralists in Africa or camel-keeping pastoralists in Arabia. It's been addressed to the Chinese empires of the past, rather than to the China of Mao and of Zhou. It's been addressed to the India of the Mughals, rather than the India of the viceroys. And it's been addressed to the empire builders of the central Eurasian steppe, people like the Mongol, rather than to those people in that area who've got increasingly sucked in to the industrialization of the Russias. You can still find in various parts of the world people who are not postmodern. You can still find people who are not living in Los Angeles or in London. But it is worth saying about something about what seems to have happened, not just with the Industrial Revolution, but also with the emergence of what J.K. Galbraith characterized as affluence. One ought to point out, of course, that the Poles, the Muscovite Russians, and the Ukrainians, people who live in East Central and Eastern Europe, have actually not yet experienced affluence. They've also not experienced some of the features which I'm talking about now. Let's focus on Britain, which is a useful place to look at. It's not very big, its population is very large, but it is a place where we can begin to come to terms with what affluence in the aftermath of industrialization has done to people. But of course, if you want to see the supreme example of the outcomes of affluence, the place to go is the United States, and perhaps most particularly of all, California. California, said Alastair Cook back in the 1960s, California is the image of all our tomorrows. So far, nothing that's happened in the more than 30 years since he said that has done anything to prove him wrong. What then are the features of the postmodern? What are the features of what affluence does to industrial societies? Well, the feature that I would emphasize particularly at this stage in the human story is the disintegration of communities. Because anyone, I suppose, who's half interested in history or in anthropology knows perfectly well that the real basis of discussion is not the human species, nor the human individual, but the human community. The real unit of human life is not the individual, and it is not, as we're often told, the family. This is an illusion. The family is not the basic unit. The basic unit is the community. It's a group of 50 to 100 people who know each other very well and are prepared to cooperate in crises, and even in the intervals between crises. I come back at this point in the lecture to my point of departure about halfway through, when I started talking about communities, about the newer village, the clearing in the Amazonian wet forest, the group of bushmen in the Kalahari who build their little brush shelters together round the same complex of fires. These are what it's all about. This is what the historians are writing about, the villages around the little churches that made up the landscape of feudal England. The villages in the Near East and India, which have been there much, much longer than the empires that come and go around them. Dynasties come and dynasties go, but the village goes on and on and on. Sometimes, of course, to a remarkable degree. In the Near East, in Turkey, for example, there are places where you can dig your way down through the mounds of debris that have accumulated on the sites of these villages, villages that have lasted for thousands of years, literally thousands of years. No empire in human history has ever lasted 1,000 years or anything like it. Now, this is something which we really do have to take seriously. The importance of these communities in human life is critical, which means that their disappearance is critical. If you live in London, you will not, as a matter of certainty, belong to a community unless perhaps you are a member of certain immigrant groups. Immigrant groups in modern Britain do manage to hold together units which perhaps are genuine communities still. If you go and live with Sikhs in the Gravesend area of Kent or on the Kent-London borderland, you can perhaps find yourself in units which are genuinely still communities. They still have their roots in the village community structure of the Punjab. And indeed, they're in constant contact with the old home country. But for the most part, in Britain today, you can assume that most people don't belong to communities, that they are essentially rootless. I don't mean to say they don't have mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and cousins, they do, but they don't belong to the units which their ancestors in the time of Chaucer belonged to, and they don't belong, certainly, to the units which we can assume among the primeval Angles and Saxons and Jutes, whom we see as our ancestors, and who, we are told, at some stage came across the North Sea and colonised Britain as the Roman Empire was disintegrating in the West. Now, this absence of community, you may feel I'm making a lot too much fuss about this, but it does have consequences which you can test for yourself. It leads to extraordinary crime rates. I have lived in places in Africa where there is no crime at all, and indeed the absence of crime is quite normal. When people in the United States or Britain talk about bringing crime rates down, none of them are talking about bringing crime rates down to normality, which is nothing. The crime rate, which is normal, is fundamentally zero. There are other features too, of course. I mean, the very fact that very large numbers of people in modern Britain are lonely, the fact that very large numbers of people in modern Britain are bored, that boredom and loneliness are both of them sort of, I suppose, they are the fundamentally no-go subjects in modern British conversation. You mustn't talk about loneliness or about boredom, because in a sense they're too important, they're too oppressive. You may talk about sex and violence, because sex and violence are fairly safe, but boredom and loneliness are not. Now, one of the things I've noticed about living in small societies is that apparently nobody is ever bored, as indeed apparently nobody is ever lonely. Loneliness and boredom are subjects which indeed are not represented even by words in many human languages. Lots of human languages don't have words for them, and apparently because they have no reason ever to think about them, let alone talk about them. Now, this upsurge of loneliness and of boredom may have all sorts of other consequences. Some people would claim that it leads to a whole host of psychosomatic illnesses. I'm not prepared, I suspect they may be right, but I'm not prepared in a strictly empirical survey to go as far as that, because that strikes me as the realm of interesting theory rather than well-established fact. Boredom and loneliness seem to me to be part of well-established fact. Another point that people sometimes make about postmodern, affluent industrial societies is that religion has either declined or disappeared. I've pointed out already that religion is a word that I treat with the utmost suspicion. Let me comment very briefly about this claim that religion has declined or disappeared. In the first place, of course, one ought to qualify religion. Well, for practical purposes, when dealing with the industrial societies, we are dealing with places which, as I indicated when discussing magic, have been long the mission field of the Christian church, so that very often religion means the organised Christian church in that area, the organised Christian church in the Ukraine, in Poland, the organised Christian church in England or in Ireland, or indeed in the state of Nebraska or the state of California. Well, in this context, what people often mean is that people don't go to church in the large numbers that they used to. There are two points about that. One is that we often overestimate the number of English who went to church regularly in the 14th century. And the other is that going to church is not in itself an indication of what people believe. I mean, I know substantial numbers of people who are Christians and who either don't go to church or who go to church rarely or would rather like to stop going to church. And the reason for this is that they are so intensely Christian that they find going to church disturbing because it's not Christian enough. Now, that's an important observation because what it means, of course, is that taking going to church as an indicator is often distinctly misleading. Large numbers of people around nowadays in the industrial countries don't go to church precisely because they are Christians, not because they're not. And that is something which we've got to take into account. Somewhere in this equation, we've got to look at what is happening to people. Many people are becoming what you might call spiritual isolates. They have very strong views about what reality is and feel themselves very strongly to be Christian, but do not find the organized context to be congenial. That is not, in some blanket term, the decline of religion. And indeed, of course, there is abundant evidence that spirituality, if anything, is on the increase in the postmodern period, and that we are dealing with an age in which, far from people ceasing to be interested in what this series of lectures is about, they are becoming, if anything, increasingly interested about it, in what is going on. They become increasingly interested in the topics which are related to this series. And if you look at California, let's get back to Alastair Cook and Letter from America, and California as the image of all our tomorrows, one of the striking features of California, as you must all realise, is that it is a world of exploding sectarian and cultic development. It is true, of course, across the United States, that sectarian and cultic development is very vigorous, but California is its finest expression. The development of these cults and sects is doubtless associated with a feature of these sorts of movements, which is, of course, that people want to belong. People want a title of a book about sects, edited by Fred Wellborn and his collaborator, A Place to Be at Home. Sectarian development has a very daily, personal, and even secular face. That is, it is to do with people whose communities have disappeared and who want to find a new community in which they feel at home. That's clearly very important. It relates directly to what I've been saying. But at the same time, of course, these sects and these cults are always to do with doctrine. They are always to do with ritual. They are always to do with the interpretation of reality. And it is a safe guess that these sects are not only going to increase in numbers and vigour in the United States, but that they're going to do the same throughout the industrial world. Already, of course, in Japan and in South Korea, the prevalence of sectarian and cultic development is very marked. If you go to Japan, you find a strange phenomenon developing that whereas the criminal organizations are very highly organized, very disciplined, very patriotic, very public-spirited, and very ready to cooperate with the police, they fear the development of the Buddhist cultic groups. It is the Buddhist cultic groups which are now the sinister force, the emerging underworld of Japan's orderly, affluent society. A remarkable development in a country which, if you know how Japan works, you realise both how ironic this is, but also how totally Japanese it is. It would be the Buddhists that would pose the threat to Japan's social order and cultural civilisation in the long run. Now, I don't want to go on and on about the postmodern, the affluent, or the long-term fate of the industrial societies. We live, of course, in an age of Armageddon, in an age of uncertainty, in an age of millennial expectation. And it is a safe probability that industrial societies, as we know them, will not last long in this form. But what I want to emphasise is that although this is really a separate course of lectures in itself, bouncing back into the mainstream, main theme of what I've been talking about, I've been talking about human beings when they were still normal. And indeed, of course, some of them, surprisingly, still are. You can still go to places in South America and tropical Africa, in New Guinea, and in other Pacific islands, and find people who are still perfectly normal at the present time. They haven't really become postmodern or moved into an age of affluent, and some people would add, decadent industrial social organisation. At this point, as I draw this series of lectures to an end, I want to go back to emphasise the fundamentals of what human beings have long been, the huge amount of evidence we have at our disposal which indicates the regularities in human behaviour, human knowledge and human perception, and of course, looking slightly forward, one can safely predict, I suppose, that these features are going to play a very big part in the formation of the California and the Japan of the future. There's very good evidence that people are already reeling back from the postmodern towards a kind of primitivism. They would like to go and consult shamans. They would like to live in small, coherent communities where there is no crime and where everybody believes more or less the same things about reality and where people know each other and can trust each other. However, this is not the point for me to comment any further on that, because at this stage, this series, in a sense, spontaneously runs out.